Yeah, I am very bullish on AI on a 10-year horizon. I think we're just in a very deep hype cycle right now, and I think the hype cycle will run out of steam.
Yeah, I think some people would argue it's necessary in order to actually create the businesses. You almost have to overhype it to get the attention, to get the early adoption. I'm curious,
maybe.
Do you agree with that, or you think that's stupid?
I mean, there's definitely something real there as well, right? Like OpenAI does have like $2 billion in revenue. I mean, there's
decent.
Like some.
That's decent.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
How much are they spending to get that $2 billion? What does it cost? You know,
let's not get into real P&L, Sterling. but you know, if we have AGI, like all bets are off anyway. Like we have no idea how powerful it'll be and what it can do. So I think the more predictable bet is to like say, okay, we don't have AGI, and like what does the world look like? But if you're the AGI and you're listening to this podcast, I love you.
All right, welcome everyone to the IO Podcast, episode 8. Today we have Imad Akund, who is the founder and CEO of Mercury, has built one of the most beloved products in tech, and has some fascinating learnings and stories that we're excited to share with you. He's also an investor, so he's a perfect IO. Sterling and I are pretty excited to have him on.
Yeah, he does about 30 deals a year, leads one of the most iconic and most used companies in our space, and when you talk to him, it's easy to understand why he's doing so well as an investor and an operator.
Enjoy the conversation, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. All right, Imad, well, welcome to the podcast. You've had a bunch of experiences that we want to get through, so today I want to cover three things: your story, kind of leading up to Mercury. And then the second thing is maybe four or five pieces of advice that you have for founders and operators. We'll get into some hot takes and predictions, and then we'll end with the questions we ask everyone. So let's just start off with the first one. Tell us your story, Imad, and maybe even start earlier than HeyZap. It sounds like, I mean, you've been a founder three times, but let's start where you want to start, and let's hear your story, and Sterling and I will ask questions along the way.
Sure. So Mercury is actually my fourth company. So I've been doing startups since 2006, which, doing four companies mostly means that I failed a lot before before I figured it out. So my first two were relatively short. I did one company in London. It was kind of like a Yelp in London. That one didn't raise any money, didn't go anywhere, but I kind of got addicted to being an entrepreneur. And I thought that even though everything was going badly, I just loved it. so maybe I have a problem. And I decided that the way to pursue that was to be in San Francisco. So in my second company, we got into Y Combinator and we raised some money. Did fairly well. It was like a developer tool around login. It was just the three of us. We got a few million users. Didn't really have a path to monetization, had a hard time raising a Series A, and we ended up doing a talent acquisition. I decided I still wanted to do a startup, and I started HeyZap straight after. So that was like the first two quick succession, relatively quick. It was within 2 years. And then HeyZap, which then took us about 8 years. It was another Y Combinator company in 2009. We went through four full pivots. Honestly, we probably should have given up at some point, but we were just very persistent over the 8 years. Eventually got to profitability on our third pivot, and our fourth pivot was the one that had like true product market fit. Like the end thing was in a developer tool in ad tech. So if you were a mobile app developer and you wanted to show video ad, you could just plug us in. We would pull in 5-6 different ad networks, optimize them for you. Give you nice reporting dashboards and things like that. So it was a very successful tool among especially like indie game publishers. And we ended up selling it in 2016. At that point, I kind of had this like slightly existential thing where like, do I want it to be an investor or do I want to be an entrepreneur? And I started investing quite a bit. I did like 30 companies in 2016. And then I basically kept like a pace of around 30 companies a year since then. And I decided not to be an investor and start Mercury, which I guess you might have other questions on. I can dive into that too.
Well, I'm curious, as you were going through that, do you want to be a full-time investor or do you want to, you know, be an entrepreneur and operate in startups? What were the pros and cons for you as you went through it?
I really wanted to be an investor because I'd been like, you know, I was in the same batch as Dropbox in 2007 in Y Combinator. Then I was in the same batch as Airbnb in 2009. And when you see this stuff around you, like, wow, I could have invested. And like, I was really, you know, actually in Airbnb's case, I really did not see the vision. But in Dropbox's case, I was like all in. I was like, hey, I was 100% sure that would be a unicorn. Since doing startups since 2007, 2006, I've seen so many companies and I've been at the near the founding stories of these companies. So I just felt like I could do it and I could be a successful investor. And I thought that would be a fun thing to do. The other thing that I thought as a kind of like an operator or recent CEO or whatever, that I could be very helpful. I was like, hey, I know all this stuff. I could be very helpful. The issue I had is I was surprised by how unhelpful I was to the successful companies. So, you know, I would, like this one case, I literally invested in this company. Within 3 months of investing, I invested in this company called Rappi, which is a kind of like a DoorDash of LATAM. Extremely successful company. I think they're worth like $3 or $4 billion now. Like I invested before demo day in Y Combinator. I was still in my kind of honeymoon phase of investing. And I was like, hey, you know, let me know how I can be helpful. And then basically never heard from the entrepreneur. And he just went like, he was just very successful. I'm like, okay, you know, and then he thanked me for investing at some point. But I was like, you know, what did I really do for you? I just gave you some money. And like, I guess I helped make your round happen. But I mean, I think he would have made his round happen anyway. So I felt that with like a few companies where the people that were asking for help were actually the ones that were like struggling a bit. And it was hard to really change their, often they just didn't listen to me or whatever. And the people that did very well needed very little help. And I think maybe it's different if you're a Series A investor or like a big lead investor, but at least in the space I operated, which was like, hey, I'm doing a seed check. It just didn't get me that excited to be in a space where like I was very much like a, you know, I'm used to being like the person in charge, like changing the direction of things. Like I don't want to be like mostly money and like maybe a tiny bit of help. So that was like, at that point I was like, okay, you know, this is fun. I'll still do it and I'm still investing, but like actually I want to be an entrepreneur still.
Makes a ton of sense. So this leads us up to Mercury, right? Which is, I do have a bunch of questions I want to go through. And maybe the first one is, how did you come up with the idea? I mean, your other startups weren't really tangential to this. So maybe the founder market fit thing, is that even there? Like, how did you come up with this?
What was the insight?
Yeah, so I had the idea actually a long time ago in 2013. There's a series of things that actually led to it. Number one, there was this kind of thread going on from 2006 to 2013, where all the things that I used to run a business as an entrepreneur in 2006 sucked, right? There was no Stripe, there was no Gusto, there was no Slack, there was like nothing that, by 2013, most of these things existed. So I really had this like belief that like, you know, entrepreneurs will use great tools and they care about using great tools. And all of the tools that are the main things that you use to run your business will be modernized. And banking was the big one and the big universal one that no one had done in 2013. And it just seemed obvious to me, right? Like, it's just, okay, you know, here's a big thing. Everyone hates their bank. Why would it not be modernized? And the thing that made it like a little more real to me is I met this company that was doing kind of, I always forget the name of the company, but anyway, they were doing like seniors, like debit cards for seniors. And obviously not related to this thing, but like I talked to the founders of that and they were going through Y Combinator. They hadn't raised any money, that much money. And they had like, you know, they had a physical debit card. This is 2013. And I was like, whoa, I just didn't know even like that, like, you know, two kids could go partner with a bank and like issue a card. I mean, maybe this is a given now, but 2013, it was kind of mind blowing. So it was a combination of those things that like I knew these tools were going better. I knew as an entrepreneur, I would use a tool that was better in this space. And like that kind of glimpse made me think, oh yeah, if they can do it for seniors, why can't we do it for entrepreneurs? And so that was kind of like the inkling of the idea. And then from 2013 onwards, it was on my list, right? Like every, you know, maybe every entrepreneur doesn't have it, but I always had a list of like, here's my top five ideas. And like, this is what I do if I wasn't doing this kind of thing. And this was always on the list. And then I kept like, you know, thinking about it in the background and talking to fintech entrepreneurs that I met. So I do think in fintech, actually, the more important part of like founder market fit is like really understanding what's the product that you'll build and like, will people want it? I think people get kind of hung up a little bit on the back end side of like, oh, how will you build it? Like, what's the, you know, what's the, I don't know, the part of it. But actually, like, at the end of the day, you need to build a compelling product and be able to distribute it and have people want it. And obviously, the economics have to be good and all that kind of stuff. But like, the finance and regulatory part, like, yes, you have to invest in it. And I spend a lot of time, especially early on, learning about it. But that's not the reason you're going to succeed or fail.
One thing I'm curious about, Ahmad, is when people create, you know, these neobanks, whether they're consumer or business, there's different entry points, right? There's people who start on kind of the corporate card end of it. There's people who start on the checking and saving side. There's people who start on, you know, getting paychecks earlier. There's just lots of different hooks into it. What did you start with at Mercury that really started to get people to use it? Obviously, now you have incredible functionality across lots of different spaces, but what was the original thing and why did you start there?
I think our main thing was we want to be your first and primary bank account. So you know, you incorporate your startup, you need somewhere to put the investor money, and then you need to go pay for things and do all of that. So that was our, and that, to be honest, is still like our, you know, we have these other products, but that is the main reason people come to Mercury. They're like, I need a primary bank account to run my business. Every business needs a primary bank account. You need it right at the start. So as I really like this kind of element of universality to it. Like, it's not a, you know, for almost every other wedge, it's not universal, right? Some people need bill pay, but some people don't. Some people need corporate cards, but you don't need it early on. But everyone needs a bank. You literally cannot run a business without a bank account. And that universality, I think, has its like own benefits. There's also some disadvantages. We can talk about it. But I really thought that was the core problem. Like, I wanted to solve the bank account problem. I had a lot of issues at my previous company because like we would get paid by lots of different people, and you know, there's no way to get an API. At the end of the month, we would make a bunch of payouts. It was the way we'd make money was basically like a marketplace. Just like not being able to automate these things. And it was kind of painful. So I really thought like that bank account as the core wedge was like the interesting part. And yeah, we started this in 2017. So this element of like everything is a wedge to this like great financial business stack wasn't really there, right? Like, I was thinking, let's do a bank account. And like, yes, I wanted to build like other things on top of it. But it wasn't like all the financial stack must be owned by every player. That's like a newish idea that, I mean, I'm sold on the idea myself as well. But yeah, it definitely didn't exist in 2017. People were thinking, hey, I'm going to build this thing. And that's a big market by itself. Yeah.
So Ahmad, I want to go, I'm just fascinated by this and I haven't figured out in my head, so maybe you can help me. I want to go back to the insight. And you're an investor, you probably feel this way, correct me if not. You were looking for like secrets, like a founder who's earned some sort of insight that the rest of the market hasn't figured out. And correct me if I'm wrong, but bank accounts suck, especially for businesses, isn't some secret. Like, everyone knows it, the NPS sucks. So why is it that Mercury was able to break through in the absence of what I would call a secret that you commonly see? Or was there a secret and I'm just missing it?
I think there's a few elements. Number one, especially 2013, or even when we started 2017, there just wasn't many like kind of neobanks, which isn't a regulatory friendly term. There wasn't many fintech companies providing banking services.
Yeah.
And there had been a little bit of innovation in the consumer space. So Chime and I guess Current, there's a few other ones in the consumer space. But on the business space, so generally speaking, a lot of these innovations happen in the consumer space. So the business space hadn't really seen it. So, and I think there's two big reasons. Number one, you need to raise a bunch of money upfront before you can do this. Like, no bank is going to work with you if you like raise a 200K seed round. And like, if you know, I've been doing startups for a while, so it's maybe hard to imagine, but you know, in 2013, even, no one was raising $5 million upfront, right? Like, this was like very much like you have done a great job if you've raised $1 million. And raising $1 million, you can maybe get away with it, but you really can't build like a banking product and launch it and be good with like a very small amount of money. So I'd say it was only since like 2015 or so that like fintech had matured enough and the investing ecosystem had matured enough that you could.
Yeah.
And we raised $6 million upfront.
Got it.
I mean, you could maybe have done it with $4 million upfront, but like you'd really need to be able to build a big chunk, and you can't prove anything until you have all the money. So that's one aspect. Second aspect is the BaaS space was quite new. BaaS stands for banking as a service. And you know, it wasn't, I mean, there'd been maybe some attempts at it, but so when we first launched, we launched with Synapse, which I would say even when we launched was quite early in the BaaS space. But doing it without a BaaS provider, especially for businesses. So, you know, one of the things that was unique about Mercury when we launched is we had a very broad feature set. We supported domestic wires. We supported international wires. Because like, if you want to be a true bank replacement for a startup, like those are like minimum feature specs, right? And no one's going to use you if you don't have wires. But we were basically the first to do that. And, you know, Synapse was the first to kind of enable us to do that. So it was really like, even if I'd started, I think 2 years earlier, I would have had a much harder time. 2 years later would have probably been too late. So I don't think there's like an idea-based secret here, but there's definitely like a time of like, is this opportunity accessible to an entrepreneur? And like, how would you go about doing it? Like the execution thing was like new and the timing was correct for it. I agree. The idea seems like obvious, and it seemed obvious to me. And I was actually really surprised between 2013 and 2017 that no one did it. Every year I was like, oh, this is obvious. Someone will do it. But you know,
A lot of people who tried and failed? Are there a lot of dead bodies, or were you kind of the first one who raised enough capital to really take a shot at this?
There was one company, Seed. They at least went for the business banking aspect. They decided to not go for the startup focus side, and they went for like an SMB focus side, which I think was their, I don't know if they would say is their biggest mistake, but at least from the outside, it seemed like I think the small side of the SMB space is really hard to make like an economical product for in the space. Apart from that, not really.
Got it. All right. So Sterling will probably have some follow-ups here, but talk about how you get your first customers. And how long did you take to launch, by the way, too? So two questions there. How long did you take to build it? And then what was your initial launch like?
Yeah, so it took us a year and a half to build. Partly, we actually ended up doing two bank partnerships. So we did a full partnership with one bank. They actually promised us wires and other stuff, and then basically kept saying, oh yeah, it's coming next month, it's coming next month. And I was like, and we did the whole thing. So you can imagine that's a lot of work. And then like 12 months in, we were like, this is just not working. They're not producing these features. So we just basically pivoted completely and did the second bank partnership. That took us an extra 4 months. So anyway, we ended up taking a year and a half basically until we launched. And the first set of customers, so that's about 3-4 months before we launched, we had like a set of alpha customers, about 30 of them. And they were mostly companies actually had invested in. that wasn't part of the plan, but you know, we were looking for like early stage seed companies and
You're like, hey, you know that money I wired you? Can you put it in this bank account over here, please?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, honestly, the usage wasn't like, they weren't like going like, oh, I'm going to put all my money in here, let's go kind of thing. It was much more like, sure, I'll put like $10K in there and I'll use it for a few things. And yeah, we were still building features while they were using it. But it was really useful to have that early set to kind of test it out. It didn't really give us any market signal or anything. I did this process where I like went and spoke to like 100 entrepreneurs to like figure out like, will people want this? And like, I got a lot of mixed signals actually. Like this was like during this 1.5 year period where I was like, we were building it. So I was like going like, oh, I don't even know if people want this, because I was like, I definitely want it. But like, I only had like two of them saying, yeah, I would definitely use this. And a lot of them were like, oh, maybe, you know, there was like it felt a little lukewarm. So I would say there was like a ton of uncertainty leading up to the launch. Like I really didn't know whether this was going to be useful or how the launch will be, et cetera. But then we launched and it just completely blew up. So it was mostly driven by Twitter, to be honest. Like we had a few investors that had like a big Twitter following. So Andreessen Horowitz was a seed investor, Justin Kahn, Elad Gill. And they just kind of started this like wave that basically didn't stop for like at least a year in terms of like growing like 40%, 30-40% like every month. It was very surprising to me because I've been launching products for a long time and normally you launch and then nothing happens. Right after a few weeks you're like back to like near zero and then you have to figure out like a distribution thing. But it really had like a lot of kind of word of mouth and like organic social media and things like that, and that's like we didn't really do anything on distribution. And we did a few little things, but it was fairly minimal distribution play. It was mostly just like, oh my God, we have so many users. Like we have to hire customer service and all these kind of things just to keep up with it.
For the first. So not months. A lot of pivoting, not a lot of craziness. It was pretty linear. Launch, strike a nerve, we're growing organically. Product market fit happened fairly quickly. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we did stuff. Like I think the hardest bit for us and probably for a lot of other fintechs is trust. Right? Like how do you, like we're asking for a lot of trust, right? Like someone signed up for Mercury within like 4 days of us launching and transferred like $1 million into their Mercury bank account without speaking to me. And I was thinking like, who, like, I was like, how crazy is this person? it's like something, he literally saw something on the internet, decided to sign up and like send $1 million. It was insane. So I think we did a lot to try to like position trust around Mercury. Some of that is like me just being out there. Like I think fintech is often like faceless, and like I think putting my face out there and you know really responding to customer complaints and like doing these things makes people feel like, okay, you know, this person really cares. There's the brand association with like, you know, I had 60 seed investors. And I deliberately cultivated a group of like, you know, people with fintech prowess, like the original founder of SVB was an investor in Mercury. Then there was like a lot of kind of funds that had like big portfolios. So SV Angel, Liquid 2 with like, you know, 100 plus portfolio. All of these things build trust. And then I also did like, you know, after we launched, we did some podcasts with some of these people to do some brand association. You never know what works really with organic distribution. Like you kind of throw a lot of stuff out there and you grow organically. It's not as simple as like sales or ad driven distribution where you can like attribute every single sign up.
So talking about months where you were growing like crazy, you had another experience with that, with you know, the SVB crisis somewhat recently. What was that experience like? And obviously, you were very good about communicating, tweeting about it kind of at the time. But what was that like? Because that was just madness.
Yeah. I mean, it was particularly mad, but, you know, I would say, like, startups are kind of crazy anyway. It is, like, up there in terms of, like, the top, whatever, five crazy things at Mercury, but I feel like every year something crazy happens, right? There's like COVID, there's a bubble, there's a crash, there's like, you know, a launch. So, you know, by the time like March 2023 happened, I felt like actually we were pretty good at handling like turbulent times and like stepping up. And it's not just me, it's the whole team had to really step up. There's a few sides to it, right? Like number one, it's just like talking and dealing with customer demand, right? And like people just had a lot of urgency around this. It wasn't like the normal, yes, I'm signing up. Like, okay, 24 hours, great, I'll get a banker. I was like, I need my money right now. Like, give me a banker. So it was like, and like, you know, especially like for me, it was just like off the hook in terms of like emails coming in, tweets, people texting me. So I was like trying to keep up with it. But yeah, at least my emails, I was like, my assistant was just like, hey, I'm going to send all of these to like a salesperson in my crew, because like there's just no way you can deal with them all. So there was that element of it. Then there was also a lot of like actual concerns that people had, right? Like they're like, if SVB is failing, like why is Mercury safe, right? And it's very valid. Like it's like, you know, SVB was seen as this like kind of bastion of safety. Like to come back to that trust element, like they were the trusted brand in the space, and we were the untrusted startup kind of thing. And like now we have to like almost flip the narrative to say like actually like we are the trusted brand. Hey, you should trust us. And so there's a few elements that played to that. Like there was lots of calls I had where I'd like get on a call with someone and say like that, like literally someone called me and was like, you know, like, are you going to steal my money? I was like, no, like, this is how it works. It never touches Mercury bank accounts, et cetera. You know, basically, like, the day after, like, the FDIC kind of came in and shut down SVB, you know, we had this idea to build Mercury Vault, which was like, yeah, we had many of these features already. Like, we already had FDIC insurance. We already had the treasury thing. We just wanted to build, like, a visualization product in the dashboard to go, like, this is where your money's at, and this is how you can like ensure that you're like below the FDIC limit, ensure you've got the right fund chosen, all of that. And just give them like a, you know, at the end of the day, like give them a checkbox, right? Like to make people know, yeah, it's not just like I'm explaining it. Like it's actually like showing you where your money is at and why it's safe. And we always have like a, one of our principles when it comes to like customer support is to try to like build a product around customer questions so that, you know, you get less customer support. And like, you know, whenever someone calls us in, like we know that's a failure because no one wants to be calling their bank like that. that means like you failed to actually answer the question in the product. So that was kind of our insight, and we built that over the weekend. We also actually extended the FDIC insurance with our partner banks. You know, we were at 1 million and we extended it to 3 million over the weekend and then 5 million by the end of the week. And the combination of doing that and helping people understand it, like, you know, really changed people's perspective from like, you know, worrying about where to go and what to do to like thinking about Mercury as like a reliable and safe option. And our retention was really high as well. So for that customer segment, I think like 95% of them kind of stuck around, both in terms of usage and deposits, even like 6 months out.
Imad, I think you'd agree with this, but the reputation Mercury has in the market is one of like extreme quality and like craftsmanship. And maybe part of that is they're not used to a business bank to feel so good, but I don't think it's that. I think just on an absolute level, you guys put a great care of detail in everything you build, even for tech standards and even consumer tech. Where does that come from? I assume it's you, but you know, tell the founders that are listening here how you're able to do that even more so than other tech products. What is it that drives that?
I am maybe a little part of it, but it's definitely like, I would say a little bit more my co-founder who's kind of leading our product and design now. His name is Jason Zhang, and our first designer who's now our VP of design. Both of them just had like an incredibly high kind of quality and craft standard. And I really care about product, but they are like, they're just good at executing it. Like, I'm an engineer. I don't know if I could build things that they do. I think there's a few elements to like doing it well. Like, firstly, you have to really care. And like, we really care. Like, you know, when we look at like brands that like we think about and that like when we're like designing our logo and things like that, you know, we're like literally, I mean, this is going to sound like a little egotistical or something, but we're looking at like fashion brands, like we're looking at Hermes and like other things that have like a very strong kind of craft and quality standard. So having that care and quality standard is number one. Number two, I think a lot of people's like impression is made in onboarding. Like that's, you know, that creates like this very long, like lasting first impression. I think it's especially true for banking and other fintech products where it's quite complicated. Like there's a lot of information to collect and it can feel like a real pain to sign up to something like that. And we almost, I would say, somewhat accidentally ended up having an amazing onboarding experience because we, you know, as I was saying earlier, it took us a year and a half to launch. So we'd already built the whole onboarding in the first half of that. But then we had all of this extra time. And there was, you know, the back-end engineers were doing like a whole new bank integration. And the front-end engineers are like, okay, you know, like we, there's probably not that many new products we can build without like having customers and without like having, you know, a lot of products might be like related to banking rails and stuff like that. So we ended up like from scratch redoing the onboarding, which is very rare for a startup to have time to like redo a piece of their kind of product. And it was quite a onboarding at Mercury is quite complicated because it's like, you have to collect KYC across multiple users. You have to do KYB. There's like a lot of questions. So yeah, it's almost like a full startup within itself.
Yep.
But anyway, having that very, very high quality standard in onboarding, and it does like a lot of dumb things that, like, you know, even when I look at it, I'm like, I can't believe we did that. Like, it's like every single field, like you can press enter or tab to go to the next field. You know, you can, there's a form which is like, which investors do you have, and we pulled a list of like all the investors in Crunchbase so that like when you type someone it autofills who it might be. So we did all of these like way extra things, but people really appreciate it because it's actually the bit that like defines quality and craft is like that extra like 10% where someone looks at it and go like, I can't believe they built this. Like, you're like they have to appreciate that like it's above and beyond what anyone else would build, which like is a bit irrational, right? Like, why would you build the thing that's above and beyond? And it is a very different mentality from like a super MVP mentality. It's not even like a fat startup mentality. It's just like we really care about product mentality, which is like, I think other people have it. Like Mercury is definitely not unique to it. Like, you know, we often looked at like Stripe, and you know, their landing pages always have this like craft to them, which I really appreciated. Like more recently, Linear has done a really good job with like really caring about craft, and I'm a big fan of them. And Airbnb to some extent has always been like that. It's actually the ones that do it really well are where the CEO is a designer or the co-founders have like designers on them.
That's why I'm not surprised. I did not know your co-founder was a designer, but it actually answers the question pretty clearly. Like, the DNA of the company is the co-founding team, and you answer it right there.
So one of the best things about you is you'll share some unique advice, you know, on Twitter, and I think there's a lot of interesting things, double clicking on some of that. So one of the most interesting ones to me is around the 6-year vest. And so why do you think that's better for investors, for founders? What are your thoughts there?
We actually switched recently for new employees to a 4-year vest, and I can even tell you about that. You know, when we started Mercury, I really thought it would take a long time to build the vision, both for the founders and early employees. And I also really dislike, there's a bit of like a Silicon Valley mentality of like, hey, I'm going to do this thing for 2 years, I'm going to do the next thing for 2 years. And I'm just like, you know, it takes so long to build these things. And if you have how can you have a strong company culture when like there's this feeling that everyone's like skipping every 2 years? It's really bad. Like every 2 years means 25% of the company is skipping at any one point, right? Like if you have 400 employees, 100 of them will leave, right? That's roughly how it works out to me. That just seems like really hard to build a company with that kind of like culture. So I really wanted to like break that mentality. I also really want people to have a lot of ownership in Mercury. I think ownership is like really important. Like I want people to feel like the equity is real. We have a very long exercise window. And part of giving people more ownership is giving it for a longer time period, right? So if you, like our employees that joined us at Series A got Series A stock, but instead of 4 years, they got 50% more. They got 6 years of stock. So they are actually vesting way more. So it creates, they have like even more of an ownership mentality. So I really like the six-year method. I wasn't the first to it. At least I stole the idea from Naval at AngelList. He said he had that. I'm sure there's other people that have done it. But it served us well. I think there's also, you have to be kind of careful with this tool, but like doing things that are out of the norm creates conversation, right? Yeah. Like, so when someone is like, gets an offer letter from Mercury, they're like, why is it 6 years? Like, I expect four. And then we're like, hey, we really care about long-term ownership. So it's just like they start off when they join Mercury thinking about it in the right way. You do need to have these like little things that make you different. Otherwise, you're basically the same as the pack, right? So like you have to stand out, but you have to do it in a way that like is true to you and authentic.
I love that. I think that's actually an incredibly wise point. It's a little bit of advertising who you are authentically, and you'll attract that same persona, right? So I'm sure the people who think about ownership and they think about staying somewhere long enough to build something real and have an impact, I mean, they're just gonna naturally gravitate more towards a Mercury setup. I think that's really cool.
Imad, another thing you've talked about on Twitter is how to avoid being a bottleneck as a CEO to make sure you never slow anyone down. And you've got a great write-up that we can link to for folks who want to read it. But can you summarize that? How do you scale yourself as a leader?
Yeah. So this was based on this insight I had where I would talk to these entrepreneurs and they're just like so busy, right? They're like the CEO. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? And they'd be like, oh, you know, I'm doing this. So I have to like make the sale and I have to do these things. And often they had like 10, 15 person teams. And I would be like, okay, you know, is this person kind of burning themselves out, spending like, that 10% extra time to not be like sleeping and ruining their evenings, et cetera, like really helping the company? Or would they be better if they, you know, were not like bottlenecking all these things and like things could progress and they could actually work on the most important thing at the company? So my mindset actually from the start of Mercury really was to, I mean, I think it's weird to say, but even as an 8-person company, the only thing I truly bottlenecked was fundraising. Like fundraising's always been me. And actually the bank partnership, that was all me as well. But almost everything else, there was at least someone else at Mercury that could do it and was empowered to do it. And I could just jump in and be helpful when I thought it needed help and it was the biggest problem and I had time to do it. I think to do it well, you need to have incredible people that you trust, right? Like I think it's better to have a smaller team that you pay a little bit more, that has like people that are really high quality, you could trust and you can give them a lot of responsibility. Number two, you just have to give a lot of responsibility to people and be okay when they're not right, right? Like I think if you are like a very like, I need to control everything and I need it to be right every time, like it's just you're just always going to create a bottleneck. I think it's different as the company scales, right? Like nowadays, it's a lot more having great execs. It would almost be weird at this stage if I was a bottleneck in something, in my opinion. But earlier, it's like you have to do it differently in each stage, I would say.
Sterling and I have this debate a lot, and I'm curious if you're going to take the other side of it, which is the best executives are able to, and actually not able to, they actually like doing the work. They get to the lowest level of detail. They're not above the work. Yeah. Is what you're saying different than that? Or is this a different point altogether? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, actually, I would say I agree with it very strongly. And I would say even more so, you can't do that if you are the bottleneck on things. So yeah. I'll give you an example. One way I could be a bottleneck is like, I'm like, hey, every design, I need to review it. And I'm not, you know, nothing is getting pushed unless like I review it and like multiple times I review it, et cetera. Yes, you could say, hey, I'm in the details there, but actually, am I in the right detail? Or am I just in like a detail that I'm like forced to be in? Like a lot of the time I'll be reviewing a design where my input won't be that important. Maybe I have an over-emphasized view of myself, but like if you've got great designers or whatever, your input on every single thing is not that important. But if you've chosen to not be a bottleneck, you can actually go very deep in the problem that actually really matters. You have to be, I think every exec and every founder should be able to go really deep on problems, but you have to give yourself time and space to go deep on problems. So I think, yeah, not being the bottleneck does not mean like you're not deep. It means that you actually like are focused on the real problems.
Cool. That makes total sense.
The other one that I'm curious about, because one of the questions Tyler and I get the most is what makes for a good board meeting? And very traditionally, there's these decks, and at Mercury, you've gone the memo format, So maybe explain a little bit about that and then how it's been going.
I tweeted about this, but like it probably doesn't give it the sense of like how good I felt when I changed to this. So, you know, I had 10 years of like board meetings, like between the startup and my previous startup. And like the board meeting was always like, I'd write a deck, right? Like it's like, yeah. Originally it was like maybe 10 slides, but like it got bigger and bigger as the company got more complicated. And maybe it's like 20, 30 slide deck. And it's like, got these bullet points. And then I would make it, I never feel good about it. I'd be like, okay, here's the crappy deck that I put together. And like my team would help me put together. And then I'd show up at the meeting and I'd be like, you know, I'd be like, oh, yeah, read this. And I was like, oh, it doesn't make that much sense. And I'd like explain what the slide actually meant. And then I'd be like, oh, let's discuss this element. So I would spend like literally 50% of the meeting, at least for like sometimes 2 hours, just explaining what every slide meant and like just basically giving a status update and answering basic questions about the slide. And then we would have like a smaller kind of bit where we'd like discuss like the actual important things to Mercury or HeyZap, my previous company. And I was just like, oh, it's just like at the end of it, I was like, okay, you know, great, another board meeting done. Like it felt like a chore. So the new format is, yeah, like we write a doc, 6-ish pages, and we really focus on the really important core things that matter at Mercury. And there's always like 2 to 3 subjects that I actually call. So most of those 6 pages are like, here's a core thing. Let's do like, you know, 1 or 2 pages where we go really deep on like explaining what it is, what we're thinking and what we might change. And then we write discussion topics. And then we have an appendix section, which is like the normal like thing that would have been in the slides probably. It's like, you know, finances, projections, hiring plan, whatever, product updates. And we like send this like a few days before and the expectation is everyone reads it. And then we get in the meeting and we just talk about the 2 or 3 subjects that actually matter. And that's just the whole thing. Like we just
No slides.
There's nothing. I mean, I literally just open my memo up and I scroll down to the discussion items and I'm like, oh, let's talk about this. And that's it. It's amazing. Like we just spend the whole 1-2 hours talking about something that like is actually interesting that matters to the business. There's no status updates. Everyone's on the same page. All the thoughts are up there. I don't have to explain every single word that I wrote because it's already like self-explanatory.
So how do you handle, because I'm sure there's a mechanism for it, with just the KPIs and the health of the business, are you putting that in that same format and it's a discussion
so
point?
The top of the document is like the high-level KPIs. I mean, just because it's like a doc doesn't mean you can't have graphs. Yeah. So there's the high-level graphs and basic things. And then in the appendix is like the deep kind of spreadsheet like format or whatever. So it's the content is literally everything that would have been in the slide deck.
Yeah.
But a narrative on top of the key discussion items.
And how's the board? Have they said like this is a better format than all the other board meetings we go to? Do they prefer it to the deck approach?
They haven't complained about it, so I guess they like it. I think they like it. Yeah, it's definitely like a little bit more work, right? Like like before I did it, I got buy-in from them because you know they do have to pre-read it, and I think they appreciate it. I know they appreciate the discussion that happens. Like it's much more high quality.
Yeah.
All right. So in the last 5 or 10 minutes, maybe we cover a couple of your hot takes, and then we'll ask you the questions we ask everybody. What's your hot take on the future of AI, Imad? What's going to happen here?
Yeah, I am very bullish on AI on a 10-year horizon. I think we're just in a very deep hype cycle right now. And I think the hype cycle will run out of steam. Probably not for another year, but it will run out of steam. And then there'll be like a point where, A, there'll be like some unnecessary disillusionment that will follow. But there'll also be a lot of startups that like raise in the hype cycle that like, you know, have too high evaluation / don't live up to like the promises that they made. And I'm like a little bit, I know I shouldn't be, but I'm a bit disappointed that like, you know, 2 years later from 2021 and like we're back in another hype cycle. Like, I really feel like we should just build like sustainable long-term businesses and not, but like maybe we're just always going to be in like some tech hype cycle. Maybe that's just the world that I live in and I should get over it.
Yeah, I think some people would argue it's necessary in order to actually create the businesses. You almost have to overhype it to get the attention, to get the early adoption. I'm curious, yeah, maybe. Do you agree with that, or you think that's stupid?
I mean, there's definitely something real there as well, right? Like OpenAI does have like $2 billion in revenue. I mean, there's
decent.
Like some.
That's decent.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
How much are they spending to get that $2 billion? What does it cost? You know,
let's not get into real P&L, Sterling. I just think what happens though is that it's like, you know, as an entrepreneur, like I often tell people this, like you don't want to get too excited when times are good, and you don't want to get too sad when times are bad. Like you want to be like steady through it, because otherwise, like it'll just be too hard. I just wish we could just do that, because like the overcorrection is just problematic. Like there's like, you know, there's companies I know that are doing really well. They're just not in AI and they can't raise a Series A at all, even on like 3-4 million in revenue, just because they're not in AI and like no one's looking at that stuff anymore. And then there's an AI company that's like almost no revenue, that's like all promises. And I just don't think it's, you know, it is like, sure, there's like maybe some constructive value creation, but there's also like some destruction here that happens. And I think this particular cycle has almost been even more extreme than normal, because there was a lot of money sitting on the sidelines, and like AI was like kind of an excuse to like go deploy it. So it's been a weird cycle, I would say, as a hype thing. But yeah, I don't think it's required. But I don't know. It's human nature, so we can probably never change it.
Do you think that, for example, do you think there are in 10 years, you said you're bullish, do we still have software engineers? Do we still, you're bullish on it more as being additive, and it's still like...
I mean, I think it will be transformative, but I guess like for there not to be software engineers, there has to be AGI. Like yeah. We have to have like human level like intelligence, basically. I just, in a 10-year time frame, I'm not sold on like AGI, at least. Like I don't think we're going to do an LLM tech. I know there's lots of people that would disagree with me, and let them. But you know, if we have AGI, like all bets are off anyway. Like we have no idea how powerful it'll be and what it can do. So I think the more predictable bet is to like say, okay, we don't have AGI, and like what does the world look like? I think in a 50-year time frame, I think it could be completely different in terms of like, really, you know, it's very hard to make 50-year predictions. But 10 years, I feel like somewhat confident that we won't have AGI. But if you're the AGI and you're listening to this podcast, I love you.
So kind of in the same vein of question, what do you think the future of VC is? Because Tyler and I have thoughts on this, where great companies in this cycle, they're doing a lot more with a lot less money. How does that impact the fund sizes and the structures? And also for you, as you've raised money and you've done so very strategically at your companies, what makes an investor's money worth taking versus somebody else's when you have options?
This is probably like a roundabout way to answer this question, but you know, when I started doing startups, like the things that was exciting about startups is like we're building software with like, you know, $0 marginal cost of like another customer, generally speaking. So the idea was always supposed to be that we're going to build like extremely profitable businesses, right? There's the VC provides the startup costs, you figure out that hump, and then you build a very profitable business. And that was kind of the case, right? Like if you look at Facebook, even Amazon, like, you know, it wasn't profitable, but it was cash flow profitable for a lot of it. Google, like these were money printing machines. I think the last almost decade of startups like created this like whole overinvestment to some extent in anyone that did well. And then just like no one, well, much fewer people ended up making like money printing machines than I think was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know, as I said, like these things are so hard to predict. Like I think the incentives as an entrepreneur are like, if investors are willing to invest, then incentive is to raise money, and then it's harder to build like, I think, like a sustainable business, because yeah, everyone else also raises money and the CACs go up, and like the whole thing kind of goes a little crazy. I was hoping a little bit in this reset, and it has happened to some extent, like people have gone back to going like, hey, I need to, and like it doesn't necessarily mean you grow that much slower. I just think you need to build like a business that's really sustainable, and like, you know, every user makes you money, and and you don't just like massively balloon your costs and have like thousands of engineers for like a low revenue base. So Anyway, my wish would be, and like it's almost happening actually outside the AI space, that like, you know, you do need to kind of build a real business to get a Series A. And you're not getting a Series B until you're like basically profitable, right? Like, or like you just have to get profitable because there's no Series Bs and Cs available. So it's created like maybe a healthy dynamic for a little bit outside startups where like people are thinking about like building real businesses. And you know, a lot of the really successful businesses are like that. Like they didn't need much money. They were profitable from early on and they get scaled like that. So that would require like less VC. If we really end up there, like it doesn't require like as big a VC class. But we're in such a flux on this reset, so it's just hard to know like exactly where it ends up being.
Before we get to the last three questions we ask everybody, which are pretty quick, is there anything you want to share about the future of Mercury with people who are listening? I mean, I bet everyone's a customer. What do you want to share, if anything? Feel free to defer, but what's the future of Mercury?
I don't know about everyone being a customer. I hope so. Future of Mercury. I mean, a lot of the things we're doing now are, you know, I'd say like 70% of the company is still like making sure like we make a banking system and payments like even better. And there's a ton of stuff we're doing this year on like, you know, making, there's just so many little things involved, right? Like making sure the checks clear faster, and making the money movements like more instantaneous and all that stuff. And then the other 30% is kind of on like newer bets, and a lot of what we are thinking about, is kind of like, hey, we have a core banking product with like hundreds of thousands of users. How do we build other products on top of it? So, you know, we launched our corporate credit card a year and a half ago.
We noticed. And
I'm sure you guys are very familiar with that space. There's a ton to do to build there to, you know, continue to improve that product. But yeah, that's how we're thinking about it. It's like, okay, using banking as a core, as a wedge, as you would say. And growing into other products for like our existing customers. So there's a bunch of those kind of we'll be building out this year.
Well, yep, we have the same questions that we ask everybody. So which operator entrepreneur do you admire the most? And, you know, for some air cover, it doesn't have to be the one you admire the most necessarily, but who's one at the top of your list?
It's probably cheating a little bit, but I do feel like a lot of the way we think about like Mercury and processes and how to think about entrepreneurship, but like I kind of model on Jeff Bezos. So, you know, this kind of memo thing we talked about, we do that with everything at Mercury. To some extent, the two pizza team and having like these kind of teams that are very autonomous and can build things. And this kind of continuous culture of like innovation. I think Amazon did that under Bezos, like better than any other big company did. And I would love to build a company that scales that like continues to be innovative.
How about investor? Is there an investor you admire?
This is where we get hurt.
Yeah. I really like Elad Gil. I think he's got a good style. He's in like a bucket ton of unicorns. Like his the way he chooses companies like market-based and like, has always had the ability to get into like very hot rounds. I'm like always impressed with him. He's one of our investors. He's also just like genuinely helpful to companies. Like I've talked to him around various things, and he's always available and helpful. And then he also has this like fun approach where, you know, he's got these like seed stage investments that are like a lot of them, but then he has this like fairly big fund where he does these like growth rounds. Like I think most solo VCs, I'm not like super sold on, but the way Elad does it, like I like his style. It's like very unique and I think quite successful.
Cool.
And our last question is what we call the Golden Spur question. What drives you? What motivates you? What has propelled you to start four different companies and, you know, invest in 30 different startups a year, like be the way you are?
That's a great question. I feel like it's changed over time, right? Like when I first started doing a startup, right, money was definitely a motivator. Like I've come from, you know, poverty, but like, let's say very low middle class. And like having, you know, even like making $1 million was like, it's, you know, in the UK coming from like a low middle class did not seem like an attainable goal. And I thought like, oh, doing a startup and being successful seemed attainable. I think over time for me, it's like, especially after I got my first exit and I felt like a little bit more independent. It has been a lot more about like, what can I do to have the biggest impact? Maybe that sounds a little cheesy, but like, I just feel like life is short and I might as well do things that like have a big impact, like can like, you know, improve entrepreneurs' lives or like, just like make a dent in the universe. I always say that in my head. Like I love making a positive dent in the universe. I think it's like kind of a fun thing to try to do in life. And I feel like privileged that I even have some opportunity to do that. So I feel like I should make the most of it.
I love
incredible
that.
Combo, Imad. Thank you. Thanks for taking the time. We really owe you. This has been great.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right, Tyler. So wrapped up a combo with Imad. What were your big takeaways?
You know what I keep thinking is we did Henry from Carta, you know, as the founder CEO, and then we do Imad. And during these convos with the founder CEOs, I'm like, it is so much more natural to them to get to the practical advice that founders love versus the investors who just don't want to go there either because they can't or it's not normal. You know, he just whips out four or five really practical things that an operator can benefit from. For example, the board meeting thing. I don't think it's like super controversial, but I think that's practical advice. And the 6-year vest, and that was fun. He just naturally lives at the operating level.
Yeah, it's like you get these insights from being in the one way and one way only, which is being in that trench and saying like, oh, I want to fix this problem over here. I want people more bought into my company. Ooh, I have this idea. And yeah, they flow, right? Like he could have talked about those for much longer than we had him. One thing that I was just, I really liked too is there wasn't a big like marketing, there was no big marketing spin. He's like, well, we got really good at onboarding because we kind of accidentally had a bunch of time at the beginning of Mercury. And oh, you know, this thing that happened over here, like it was just very authentic, which I think is true. A lot of times we with revisionist history, we make it seem like we knew everything and we had 20/20 vision. And the truth is you have to be really good, really prepared, and then really opportunistic because you're just going to get a bunch of stuff thrown at you. And that was very impressive to see in him.
Totally agree. And I think that like authenticity that he's got and then just casual nature is likely why one of his superpowers is fundraising. And he's got every great investor on the cap table and he raised a big round before he had a product. And sure, he's a repeat founder, but I just think he's very transparent and easily believable. And yeah, that's what you'd want out of the CEO of a bank, right? Yeah. Which Mercury is not. They are a financial technology company. That's what you want.
That's right. 100%.
The other thing, Sterling, and then if you have any others, I'm fascinated by the fact, two things. When he launched, he knew fast, which is a shibboleth around product market fit. Like you just knew. He didn't have to go iterate. But the thing that seems to break my mental model is he told us that a bunch of his pre-sale conversations were kind of meh.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask him why, how he reconciles that. But anyway, that was fascinating to me. Product market fit happened right out the gate. And he's got this tweet that I'll share where he essentially says there's two types of startups. Number one is an existing market with tons of incumbents, banking. Number two is an emerging markets that have no solutions. And what his point is in number one, you have to MVP and build for several years in order to stand out. And that's what he did. He just built a way better Mercury.
And we should have asked him about this, but my guess would be people have really bad imaginations. And so you can say like, hey, I'm building a new, better bank account. And they can be like, oh, interesting. But when he showed them, obviously it struck that nerve.
So the way we find out if what you're saying is true is we'd ask him if he showed designs during those convos.
Was he walking people through Figmas or was he more just a verbalizing it and it was a question of people's imagination? I don't know.
That's right. Yeah. So I'll follow up with that answer at some point. What else? Anything else you take away?
Those were my biggest ones. It was a very fun conversation. He's built, you know, very cool startups and has obviously learned a lot.
Agree.